You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 18. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. Today, I'm turning the microphone over to Olivia Kehoe for a story about new developments in academic publishing. Last summer, Olivia took up a studentship to help me research new trends in academic publishing. You see, I teach a course on science in the publishing industry here in STS, and I was looking for an intern to work with me over the summer to help update some of the topics and help me identify some new trends. Olivia was quick off the mark, and before long, she was interviewing people in academic publishing, working hard to get a sense of the real cutting edge in that industry. Olivia offered to push those conversations a bit further too, and to create an episode for the podcast. This kind of freelance portfolio building work is precisely what we had in mind when launching We Are STS as a series. On top of everything else, I think Olivia really has engaged the issues of her story. How is peer review evolving? What might the system look like in 10, 5, or even 2 years' time? These questions are crucial for the subject of quality control in science, medicine, and across all academic fields. Academic publishing is an industry worth billions of pounds. People's lives and reputations are at stake. This stuff really matters. Well, enough from me. I'll let Olivia take things up from here. Her journey begins with a simple question, and I'll see you on the other side.
How do we know that when a scientific paper is published, we can trust it? Without going into a philosophical discussion on what counts as fact or evidence or truth, the answer given is usually peer review. It's a term that's synonymous with academic publishing and that affords it the status of producing rigorous research, but there's definitely more to that story. My name is Olivia, and on this podcast I talk to three guests in some way involved in the peer review process through their work. I get their take on what it's all about, whether it's fit for purpose, and what direction it's going in. We briefly discuss two different initiatives pioneering an alternative form of peer review, one that's open and transparent, and could be the future of scientific publishing. I first spoke to Sambul Akhtar, who is journals coordinator at UCL Press. Having worked in publishing for over 9 years, she was a great person to begin talking to about the ins and outs of peer review. So, what actually is peer review, and what does it mean for the publishing process?
In publishing, in particular, is sort of like the gold standard of publishing. So, if you've done your research and you've spent like, you know, 9 months or a year compiling your research into a paper and you've submitted it to a journal, they will send it to your peers, so people who are in your industry, who are considered experts in the field, in order to review that article. So your article is getting a once-over and a very thorough look at by experts in the field, and they will pick out the minutest details. Like we'll have articles where reviewers are like, what's the methodology, like it hasn't been explained properly in this article, and then the author, that those comments would go back to the author to consider making revisions to their paper.
And this process can go through several cycles before a manuscript is accepted for publishing and incorporated into the academic literature of that field.
If you're an expert in your field, for example, mm-hmm. you've been around for a while, it stops reviewers who might have a grudge against someone from exercising that mm-hmm. when they review that manuscript and reviewing it badly on purpose, because mm-hmm. they don't know who's written it.
So peer review also plays a key role in preventing any bias in the decision process. In principle, this peer review model seems fit for purpose and necessary for a kind of quality control in science and academia. But having done a little bit of research myself, I know there are problems. I asked Sumbul for her opinion.
You know, peer reviewers are not paid for the work that they do. Often, and traditionally, when something is reviewed, it's reviewed anonymously. Traditionally, it's called blind peer review. So that's when, or double blind peer review, and that's when the reviewer doesn't know who the author is. The manuscript has been anonymized. The issue with the publishing industry is that you kind of get all of that labor for free. So when a paper is anonymously reviewed, the reviewer isn't getting any type of acknowledgement for the work that they do. They also, you couldn't have a manuscript that's published and then have someone say, oh yeah, I was a reviewer for that manuscript. You wouldn't be able to do that. Yeah. So there's no acknowledgement.
I heard this sentiment echoed by Denis Bourguet, who is Director of Research at the National Research Institute for Agriculture, Food and Environment in France. When I asked him about the issues with peer review, he highlighted the lack of acknowledgement that reviewers would get and the time pressure on them to do it.
The main issue, I would say, is that we have no time, or reviewers have no time, or take no time, because the system is like this, and making pressure. Making reviews in a day or 2 days, maximum 3 days now. And in the ideal world, the reviewers will make again the analysis to make sure that they can reproduce your analysis.
Right.
And probably no reviewers is doing this. I've heard about people that they just consider that writing a review cannot take more than 2 hours or 3 hours. And that's, for me, that's just not possible.
Yeah.
If you want to do a good job. So there's clearly a kind of trade-off between the time you are spending on peer review, and you can always do better, and the time you want to save you for your own research. And due to the evaluation procedure right now, people are saving much more time for doing their own research rather than making very in-depth peer review.
Combined with the tight turnaround times expected of these reviewers, who are also working researchers and scientists, he suggests it incentivizes the wrong kind of reviewing, one that prioritizes speed and therefore numbers rather than thorough reviews.
Currently, there is no incentive for making very good reviews. There is a small incentive for saying, okay, I've peer reviewed 20 people last year, but nobody will look if you have done very good reviews or very light reviews. So there's even an incentive for making light reviews.
Yeah, right? Being as efficient as possible in...
Exactly, because you give a number, you don't give exactly a link to what you did.
Going back to Sumbul, she then talked about the experiences she's had more generally working in commercial publishing, specifically a large corporation that publishes medical research. This actually led on to a wider conversation about the commercial publishing business model and how it's taken advantage of the status and reputation that high-impact journals still have among researchers.
Yeah, so what I was noticing towards the... So I started my career a decade ago. What I was noticing towards the end of my career in commercial publishing is that a lot of the onus was falling back on the author.
Yeah.
So you'd have the author who's created, who's done all of this research and who's written it up, and they would submit it to a journal. And then they would also, once it's gone through the peer review process and it's ready, it's been accepted, it needs to go through copy editing and proofreading, that onus would fall back on the author. So so commercial publishers are less likely to hire a proofreader, they're less likely to hire a copy editor, because they're just well, we can ask the author to do that.
Yeah.
And the idea is that authors must be so desperate to have their research published that they would do anything in order to comply with these demands that major corporate commercial publishers have of them.
She points out that this is reflected in the cost of open access publishing, called the Article Processing Charge, or APC. To give a bit of background, in the standard traditional model, Libraries and institutions would pay subscription fees in order to access journals, e-journals, and all the latest literature needed for research to go on at places like universities. It's just like a Netflix subscription, where paying a monthly fee gets you access to thousands of films and TV shows. But with open access, specific articles and papers are available for free, but these journals instead now charge individual fees for publishing that paper. So instead of paying to read, you pay to publish.
When you look at those APC charges from different publishers, it just blows your mind. Like, they can charge so much, and the funding exists because institutions are able to pay for their researchers to publish open access. But what happens is you have commercial publishers that inflate the price.
Yeah, and how do you think we can move forward from that, given that institutions and funders are still willing to pay?
Yeah, there needs to be a revolution. As like an individual person, I'm not representing the views of the institution at all that I work for.
Yeah.
But I do think that publishing needs to, the entire industry just needs an overhaul. And that's actually something that UCL Press are spearheading and we're revolutionising.
So as I found out, UCL Press have journals just like other publishers do, but they have one journal that is unique in that it's open peer reviewed. It's called UCL Open Environment, and you can follow them on Twitter. But what does open peer review actually mean in practice?
So the review process is open. It's not anonymized at all. The reviewer knows the author and the institution, like the manuscript is not anonymized to the reviewer.
Yeah.
It also enables the reviewer to have like full acknowledgement of the work that they've done. Their review gets a DOI, so it gets like it's given the same status as an actual manuscript, so you can cite it in your work. There's like a dialogue. You can have a dialogue. That's basically what we wanted, to encourage people to have a dialogue about the research that's being conducted, and also to give, I mean, I don't have like concrete proof that this happens, but there's this idea that you will have, especially medical research, you'll have a bunch of researchers doing research in a completely niche area, and they've found something that's quite groundbreaking. They've written about it, submitted to a journal, and then a reviewer might want to take credit for that themselves. So they'll recommend that that paper is rejected. Their comments are anonymized. Nobody knows they're doing this.
Yeah.
So they'll recommend that comment is rejected and then publish something similar themselves or do research in that area.
Mm-hmm.
With a preprint server and open peer review, everything is very open. So the credit would go, like you can very easily determine who set the precedent, who wrote about it first, and where the credit should go to.
A big advantage of making peer review an open process, then, is that reviewers are encouraged to be more rigorous and spend more time looking over each manuscript, because their review will become part of their own published work. But in reality, this same openness could also have its drawbacks. While it offers more accountability and more recognition, it also allows in bias, like friends or colleagues recommending your paper, or even the opposite, having much fewer reviewers participate because of the perceived risk of having their opinions out in the open.
The drawback of open peer review is that it's so new, and a lot of reviewers are like, well, I don't really, a lot of reviewers are hesitant basically to post their review because they don't know the repercussions that it will have on them. Whereas when something is blinded, you don't know who your reviewer is, you can be really harsh. I've read really harsh comments as well. And there's like all these memes about reviewer number two on the internet. You should totally like just check out like hashtag reviewer number two on Twitter and just see what the academic community have to say about who reviewer number two represents, because you'll often have like one reviewer who will be like, okay, this manuscript's okay, it needs work, and on these particular areas, and on line 115 there's a typo, like, but then you'll have reviewer two that's like, this manuscript is rubbish, like it should not be published, and like really contrasting reviews. So there's this sense of accountability in open peer review that some reviewers are new to, so they're kind of hesitant to commit to. I imagine in a few years, a lot of, like, it's the same with open access. When that first started, I remember people were like, what is this? Like, how do we publish open access? And now, 10 years on, everybody wants to publish open access. There are the whole desks and offices in institutions that cater for their researchers to publish open access.
Right.
And I imagine something similar will occur with open peer review as it becomes more established.
This sentiment was echoed by Catherine Sharp, who manages UCL's open access funding and has been at the forefront of these changing trends in policy between institutions, funders, and publishers of open access.
Knowing and being able to see and having peer review published, I'm sure there will be a move to that. And I'm sure that, you know, openness more widely, open data, open software, open code, and all the sort of associated, making all the associated outputs open. And sort of moving towards a situation where the journal article is not the be all and end all. You know, you've got maybe a suite of kind of outputs from a piece of research, and they're all linked and openly available. That's definitely sort of the way that it's going. Yeah. I think it's just going to take a while to get there.
So the reason I first got in touch with Denis Bourguet, who we heard from earlier, was because I came across the initiative that he co-founded called Peer Communities In, or PCI. This takes a similar approach to the open peer review process that the UCL journal is adopting. When a manuscript is submitted to PCI, at least two individuals in that field or community are invited to review the paper. After one, two, or more rounds, their recommendations are then published alongside the actual paper and are freely available to read. It addresses many of the issues that Denis brought up to do with the quality of peer reviewing that he'd encountered. I wanted to round off this podcast by returning to Denis, since this is what started my research on peer review and how it's evolving.
How do you see the peer review process and PCI evolving in the next 10 years? Where do you think peer review might stand?
Well, one way could be like to better check data code script. So step by step, you probably have seen this. There is a lot of pressure, or start to be some pressure by journals in general to authors to publish their data script codes in open repository to make them available. But again, it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of time. So yeah. So we could do that, but we are thinking about doing this. But that's a big step.
I found that it was an interesting coincidence that these two initiatives are completely independent of each other, yet have found parallel approaches to revolutionising the peer review process. For both PCI, Peer Communities In, and UCL's Open Peer Reviewed Journal, this is such an important move, away from what could sometimes only be described as a black box of peer review in traditional models. From questioning what peer review is, whether it's fit for purpose, and what the alternatives would mean, there seems to suggest a growing consensus that something needs to change. From speaking to Denis, Stumble, and Catherine, I found that the concept of openness in science isn't just in abstract philosophical terms, but happening in real and practical ways. For scientific publishing, open access, open peer review, and open data seem like a promising future for the way science is done.
Thanks to Sambul Akhtar, Denis Bourguet, and Catherine Sharp. And thanks for listening.
Well, I think it's a mark of a great project that it leaves us wanting to know more and to know better than we did at the start. Thanks to Olivia Cahoe for this episode. What a brilliant example of the value of studentships. The more experiences students get, you see, the better prepared they are for the future. And thanks also to the MAPS faculty here at UCL. That's the Faculty of Mathematical and Physical Sciences. They provided the money for us to pay Olivia for her summertime work. Music today included two pieces, Rollin' at 5 and Acrylate, both by Kevin MacLeod, and both available online at the site filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to know more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, just visit us online. Here's the address, so write this down. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. That's it for today. Thanks for coming along. We'll have another episode ready soon. In fact, we're planning a blizzard of student podcasts for you shortly. Very exciting stuff indeed. So until next time, everybody, just remember, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere, and that together, we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.